A third major area of visitation involves crisis visitation. And this would include such things as a death in the family or a terrible accident. If the crisis involves a death or an accident, always, always go. Crisis situations are times of sudden shock, pain, disbelief, and disorientation. And your presence as a minister can be very reassuring at these times. Now, how far do you take this? If someone's aunt dies in Toledo, and you and your parishioner live in Sacramento, are you expected to visit? And how close of a relationship must exist before you consider it a family death? Well, these are judgment calls, and it's always appropriate to visit if the crisis is within the immediate family. And if it is not, then use your best judgment. It can never hurt to go and show your concern, and it is always better to err on the side of cautious judgment than to misread the situation. There are other areas of visitation that I want to mention, but only have time to offer a brief comment. The visitation of delinquent members should not take up much of the pastor's time. Allow others to visit them. Now, a lot of people would disagree with me here, but I would rather spend my time with individuals who participate in being a part of the church than wasting it on trying to get those who don't want to be there to come. Now, I'm not saying you forget about them, but don't give them much of your time either. Another area of visitation concerns the discipline of church members. This is an important aspect of ministry that cannot be shunned. And when doing this, always follow scriptural guidelines. Decisions that are made by spiritual leadership as a group help take the heat off the pastor and reveals a unified stance on the issue. Now, during my years of ministry, I have had to go to individuals for discipline. And it's never been easy. It's been rather difficult, but I knew that it had to be done. And you will face those situations as well. But follow scripture and have the backing of leadership. One of the best areas of visitation for me occurred around informal settings. I cannot begin to emphasize or to accentuate this point enough. I love to go out to lunch, I love to go golfing, and I love to be involved with people in informal settings. And the pressure was not as great for me to perform as the pastor. And I kept my ears and my eyes open, and some great times of sharing and some great times of ministry occurred informally. This can become really a major area of visitation for you. Use those things that you like to do and include others. And you'll be surprised at how much visitation can be done informally. In addition to visitation, involvement in funerals is another very common function the minister performs. A greater understanding of the purpose and the performance of the funeral may help the pastor minister with greater effectiveness in this area. You've heard it said that the only certainty in this life is death and taxes. Well, unless the rapture comes first, every human being has an appointment with death. It is here that we confront our own mortality and the brevity of life. When death comes, loss and grief provide a fertile ground for cultivating impactful ministry. There is a need for care, counsel, planning of funeral services, the working through of grief, and various other duties. And your ability to bring a quiet confidence born of informed experience will help honor the dead and care for the living and point toward the immortal. An understanding of the grief process helps provide empathy and understanding on the part of the pastor. grief is not abnormal. And those who teach that Christians are to always smile and always wear their happy faces around divorce themselves from the reality of life. This life often brings severe stings. It's the price we pay for living in a fallen world. Being well aware of this fact, in John 16:33, Jesus states, "In this world you have tribulation, but take courage, I have overcome the world." See, being a Christian does not grant you immunity from the struggles and pain experienced in this life. Jesus himself experienced plenty of pain, and according to tradition, all of the apostles died a martyr's death, with the exception of possibly one. God created us with the ability to express and experience grief. The Bible is laden with examples of God's people expressing and experiencing grief. Even Jesus wept during the death of Lazarus. Shaming, guilting, and downing others for the expression of grief and viewing it as abnormal is unbiblical. Realizing that grief is normal and understanding the grieving process will better prepare you to minister and help the person come through the process in a God-glorifying manner. When death touches our family, Paul in 1 Thessalonians 4:13 wants believers to grieve, but grieve as those who have hope. About those who are asleep, that you may not grieve as do the rest who have no hope. The minister helps believers grieve according to hope. In 1917, the first careful studies on grief were published by Freud. Almost 30 years later, a Harvard professor named Erich Lindemann wrote about his interviews with 101 grieving relatives and described the 5-stage acute grief process in an article entitled Symptomatology and Management of Acute Grief. In the American Journal of Psychiatry. His 5-step grief process included somatic distress, preoccupation with the image of the deceased, guilt, hostile reactions, and loss of patterns of conduct. In 1969, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross published a book entitled On Death and Dying, which started the avalanche of literature on the subject. And since that time, we have seen the development of a whole new literature and field of study known as thanatology. And my point is this, death and dying was not a topic of great undertaking, no pun intended, until these works had been published. These studies encouraged the clergy to examine more objectively the reactions of grief from their parishioners. After years of observing grieving individuals and discussing their experience with them, certain patterns of behavior come to the forefront. Although several have suggested different stages of grief, the 10 stages of grief offered by Granger Westberg in his book Good Grief seem to be easy to understand and inclusive of all the elements of the grief process. Stage 1 involves a state of shock. Some react differently to the news of a death, from a near total collapse to some sort of stoic strength. But do not be fooled. Upon learning of the death of a loved one, shock is initially experienced. Stage 2 involves the expression of emotion. When people realize the great loss they have suffered, there's usually a great deal of crying and emotional outletting. And it's healthy to emotionally acknowledge the pain and loss that is felt. It's harder for some to do this than others. The little boy whose dad always told him not to cry may have difficulty crying when it is appropriate to do so. Sooner or later, however, the emotions will be felt and they will be probably displayed. The third stage is the feeling of depression and loneliness. Here the individual believes no one has ever grieved the way they have grieved or experienced the severe pain and emptiness that they feel. And they wonder why God seems so distant and why he just doesn't seem to care. The dark clouds have rolled in, and it seems that the sun will never shine again. The fourth stage involves the experience of physical symptoms of distress. Emotional pain often attaches itself to physical pain. Now, there's no broken leg, there's no ulcer, but there is a lot of headaches, a lot of tensions, and a lot of upset stomachs. In ancient days, strong emotions were associated with the bowels. When Jesus looked upon the crowds with compassion, the Greek uses the word splankna, which means to be moved as to one's inwards. Strong emotion often upsets the stomach, and it is not uncommon for physical symptoms of illness to accompany grief. The fifth stage involves a state of inner panic. Individuals find themselves constantly thinking of their loss. They just can't seem to get their mind off the subject, and this hinders their effectiveness in anything that they attempt to do, because concentration is difficult. The sixth stage involves feeling guilty for the loss. This is guilt associated with the feeling of having neglected to do something that would have prevented the loss, feeling that we have failed somehow or that something was done that shouldn't have been done. And it brings on a guilt for those things that you maybe should have done or could have done, but just didn't. The seventh stage involves anger and resentment. Here the individual scrutinizes the entire scenario, angrily questioning why the event happened and who can be blamed for it. One can be mad at relatives. One can be mad at the doctor or the hospital. They can be mad at the church for not caring enough, and anything else that doesn't meet the approval of their jaundiced eye. Many people are mad at God. After all, they reason, if he is so loving, how could he have allowed this to happen? If he is in control of things, how could he have allowed this to happen? The eighth stage involves a resistance to returning to normal. The person desperately wants to get on with their life, but something inside wants to resist doing so. Others go on and seem to forget about the loss, but the loss was so special. And it was so important to this person. They want to remember the tragedy. They want to remember the importance of the loss and somehow keep the memory alive. They feel they must not allow things to get back to normal after all they have gone through. Stage 9 involves the gradual return of hope. Here the dark clouds begin to break up and flashes of sunlight again begin to light up life. They are beginning to taste again the warmth of the sunshine, the good things in life. Stage 10 is the struggle to affirm reality. Here the individual begins to affirm the reality of their loss and the reality of getting back to their old self again. A great loss changes people, for sure, but it is the response here that can make people better, stronger, wiser, and healthier in spirit. Some choose to face reality in unhealthy ways, which hinder their relationship with God and make them bitter people instead of better people. But in this stage, they're wrestling with that. They're struggling to affirm reality. Now, it is normal to move through these stages of grief. It's the grief process. If you've experienced a deep loss, you've probably gone through these steps. To get stuck in one of those, however, is not healthy. And as a minister, your understanding of the process can greatly aid in helping grief-stricken individuals move through these stages in a very healthy and a very positive manner. We desire that those in grief move through the process and not become stuck in any one stage. One might ask, what is the purpose of a funeral? This is really an excellent question and helps us realize that funeral services are primarily directed to the living. And there are several purposes to funerals that might be considered. First, funerals help family and friends remember the deceased with love and appreciation. The dead person actually lived a life among those at the funeral. If the deceased was a believer, celebrating the individual's faithfulness to Christ is appreciated. Second, the funeral allows the family to respectfully dispose of the body. Though the physical body is only a temporal housing, it did contain the life of a human being. I suppose we could just dump the corpse along the road somewhere since it no longer contains life. I've heard people say that. When I die, just drop me off in a ditch somewhere. But to do so would really show a disrespect for life. Since the spirit has departed, the body really remains the only visible, the only tangible sign that is left of the individual. So out of respect for life and for the deceased, the funeral allows family and friends a respectful way of disposing of the body. Third, the funeral service is a method of showing support and love to the living. Family and friends gather to convey affection, warmth, and understanding and support. And the living need this avenue of support as friends and family say, "We hurt too. We love you and we want to be there for you." And thus, the funeral service can be a wonderful way of showing support and love to the living. Fourth, Christian funerals allow us to lean on God for today and look toward our hope in the future. The minister has a wonderful opportunity to reassure the living of God's faithfulness, of His sovereignty, and His strength and help, which is acutely needed to carry on in the time of loss. And it's also a time to remember and strengthen God's promise of a resurrection, a promise of a new body, a promise of eternal life with Him in heaven. And the funeral allows Christians to give glory and worship to God, even in the face of death. This is the end of number 2.